So doors have closed, which is the official sign of let's get started today. So, oh, and we've got voice. So thank you for coming to my session. I have the honor of having very long session names. So today it's going to be about Link 2013 High Availability and Disaster Recovery. And yes, this is the session that is in the way before getting drinks. So we finish this, and we do some Q&A, and we get to go drinking again. A couple of things. This is a level, we consider this a level 300 session in Europe. North America considered this a level 400 session. So if you're very squeamish about Link, this might be going quite deep. We'll take some high-level concepts, but we'll also go digging quite deep into the HA and DR portion of it. So I hope you're in the right session. Before we get started, the evals, they can be completed through either the QR codes, through the session builder, or through through the TechNet app. We keep yelling about them, that you need to complete them. We would like you to complete them because, quite honestly, if you say, well, this Cornel guy, his presentation kind of sucked, I will not be here next time. Your input really forms who gets to speak, which subjects we discuss, how deep we should go in this session. So please complete them. About today. So we'll be talking about the HA and DR functionality within Link. We'll be talking about what kind of topologies do we need, how does this work. We take a bit of a deep dive into some of the underlying technologies, especially things like Windows Fabric. up until a year ago, we used to say, well, it just works, and we use some secret stuff beneath. I'll be talking about what that secret stuff is and how does it work. I think that the sort of the recap of this is, hey, I've got half of my pool online. It still doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? I'm going to explain to you why it still doesn't work today, which also means there are quite a bit of design implications because it isn't as easy as long as I have one front end up, Link will be running. So about me, clicker, there we go, about me. So I have the honor of working in the team with the longest name within Microsoft. So I work for the Microsoft Consultancy Services Enterprise Communications Global Practice. And that took me a couple of tries to get that right. I'm a solution architect. I cover the Nordics for Microsoft, so I work for Microsoft Consultancy Services, and I advocate the use of implementing Link and what Link can do for you and how you implement Link correctly. And we do that together with partners or directly through MCS. Back in the golden days, or in the olden days, however you want to call them, when we still had MCM and MCSM, I was one of the instructors there. So you can ask me stuff about Link, and I'll be happy to answer them. If you have any questions outside of this session, kbuttons@microsoft.com, feel free to add me on Link or on Skype. It all works. We had a very professional guy come in and take pictures, so I now have a very, very professional looking picture in my my bottom corner. In real life, I almost never look that professional. I'll be free to admit that. I collect Lego Star Wars, the Ultimate Collector Series sets, so if you have some spare laying around in your attic, feel free to add me a link and tell me so, and I'll be happy to take them away from you. I have a couple of issues when presenting, and I'll be very honest to you about them. I tend to move around a lot when I like a subject, and I like this subject, so I'll be moving around quite a bit. I am Dutch, which is I won't say a handicap, but at least it makes my English not the kind of English you hear on TV, and it makes me talk quite rapidly because the Dutch like to get to the point, and we like to be very quick about it too. I live in Houten, and that's the most Dutch picture I could ever find because it has clouds, it has a bit of sky, it has a lot of bikes, and it has the thing we love in the Netherlands. It's bike lanes where no car is allowed to go, only bikes. So that's where I live, and if you think I talk too quickly, or if I moved away too much and I distracted from the screen, which I can completely understand, that's why we made the screen bigger. But if I distract too much, just raise your hand and let me know, and I'll be happy to either slow down or address your question. So with that said and wasted another 5.5 minutes, let's get started on HADR. And before we do a deep dive into HADR, we really want to get the perspective set right about what is high availability and what is disaster recovery. Because everybody has their own opinion, and we as Microsoft have our own opinion, and we feel ours is right. And we have the great advantage that we actually write the software, so that sort of makes us write in Link. So when we talk about high availability, that's usually within the site. And I say usually because some of you guys must have read about, and girls, I have to say guys and girls, some of you must have read about the Metropolitan Data Center design that we used to have in Link 2010, which could get you high availability over sites, no longer supported, and today we'll show you why. So that means that high availability really is within a site, and this... this helps you guard against a single server or multiple server failure within a pool. And whether that's the front end or the back end, it's a mechanism built into Link. So even if a back end server fails, Link knows that one of the back end SQL servers has failed and tries to correct that. And this is all within the pool, within the site. When we talk about disaster recovery, we talk about stuff's gone wrong, and really wrong. This is not an accidental reboot. This is a complete site has burned to the ground. So we had some disaster recovery features in Link 2010 already. So we had voice resiliency. So if a pool went down, you could set a different pool as your disaster recovery pool, your voice availability pool. And that specific pool would then take over existing voice functionalities. You could still make calls. You could still receive calls. But that was about it. Yes, IM would still work, but your contact list was kind of empty, so didn't really help you all that much. With Link 2013, we introduced the concept of a backup pool, a paired pool, and we'll go into some details about how that works and what you need for that. And the nice thing about that is basically it synchronizes all services between pools. And when I say all services, I should do air quotes with that, because we don't cover response groups or call pickup servers or call admission control. Those require some manual intervention. All the other aspects, such as conferences, such as contact lists, such as your IM functionality, all those statuses that we have, we do copy them between the pools. So if a pool goes down, with a single commandlet, you can get your secondary pool up for the users that were assigned to the previously and now destroyed pool. We sort of see that as either it's a complete pool that has failed for some reason, and usually because we can go pretty large with pools, we would see that a single pool covers a single site. Which brings us to the second point, it's usually a site failure. Disaster recovery is there because my site has completely failed. And in that way, so we can't mix and match. So we can't do standard editions and enterprise editions or 2010 and 2013 in the same pair pool. It's always 2013 to 2013. So that's our biggest difference. When we talk about high availability and disaster recovery, high availability within the site, within a pool, a single server fails, or maybe a couple of servers fail, but within the pool, we still want the pool functional, and disaster recovery, stuff's gone really wrong. The complete site's gone. So how did we get to this point where we could actually do these things, and how do we get to this point where we sort of killed off things like Metropolitan Data Center? So with 2010, our biggest limitation was SQL. Well, because SQL is a bad product, but for some reason, SQL doesn't like it if you do dynamic updates for 80,000 users regarding whether they're online or busy or in a call. That sort of was the limit at which we were reaching stretching SQL boundaries, both in IOPS as well just as pure network bandwidth in CPU cycles. We were sort of hitting limits in SQL. So what we did, we decoupled that. So our SQL backend is still important, but it's now, we call this a loosely coupled backend. So our backend is there for non-dynamic updates. So we still store contact lists in there. We still store things like conference directories in there and conference status. But we don't use them anymore for dynamic updates, such as present status. So as online or available. Because, well, those are easily to find back. And honestly, do I really want to back up if my user was online or not? So we handle all the dynamic updates like presence on the front-end servers, and every now and then, depending on resource availability, we write some of that data back to the SQL server. We call that blob storage. So we sort of save a lot of information every now and then, we give that to SQL. And I tell SQL, well, you save that for us, you hold on to that for us. We don't really need it right now, we'll tell you when we need it. So this also makes sure that we can basically go into a 1-to-N server topology. So technology-wise, if you wanted to have 600 frontends, there is no limiting factor that wouldn't allow you to do that. The boundaries we have right now is our testing capability. We've gone to 18 frontends, and then we thought, well, if you have 18 frontends in the pool, you're going to meet some different problems than if I wanted the 19th or not. Because when you solve things, you introduce new problems. And we'll talk about some of those. So that's the biggest change, where we had the link pool with a tightly coupled backend into a loosely coupled backend. Can we go without that SQL server? No. We still need it to do that blob storage. We still need it for reprovisioning servers, and I'll show you that in a second. But we're less reliant on that backend. So looking at the high availability, let's talk about the front end's high availability first. So the secret sauce that we never really talked about and that we sort of test drove in the cloud is called Windows Fabric. And Windows Fabric is for us the successor to Cluster Manager, and it's a clustering type service that we can leverage to keep the state of services within our pool. So instead of having a very strict cluster service that says yes or no, we can use Windows Fabric, which has a whole lot of other functionality about service states and multiple servers to get quorum and things like that. So our primary things where we use this for is when we talk about routing groups. And we put our users in routing groups. I've got some very nice slides about that. But we need to think about, if we have a pool, we need to think about two different things. We need to have a pool online, and we need to have a user group online, a routing group online. So a routing group consists of our users, and our routing groups are spread out over our front ends. So that means that during startup of a pool, we need to have 75% of all front-end servers there for the election process of, is this pool online or not? So if you ever deployed a 2-front-end server pool for Enterprise Edition, and it wouldn't start up, that's because you can't get 75% with 2 servers. You need to have 75% of all servers online up and running to start your pool. I realize now that that makes absolutely no sense to you. So I'll come back to that comment later on, and then it makes way more sense. But I warned you about this already. So just think about these numbers. 75% of all front ends need to be online in a starting mode when you start up a pool. And once your pool starts, you need to have at least 50% of your front ends online to keep your pool up and running. Once you drop below the 50%, no more link for you. So, impact of that, when you look at the total of numbers of frontends in a pool, we need to have a set number of those frontends online. So for the pool to be functional in a 3-to-4 frontend pool, we need to have at least 2 server frontends, or else we won't reach that 50%. That also means if you're doing patch management, or if you're trying, if you're building a new pool, and you think, well, I'm going to do 12 frontends later on, whenever I get to it. But I'm going to deploy 5 now. That will never work. Those will never come online. That pool will never function because you didn't meet the 6 mark. Even worse, it will actually never start up because you didn't meet the 75% of servers for the pool to actually start up. So of those that have deployed Link, who has been waiting for a very long time for the front-end service to start? I know I have. I guess most people have waited for a long time, and you were very annoyed because why doesn't the stupid front-end service start? 75%. It's because of there's a voter system for pools that are online, and if you don't get more than 50% of the votes, you can't really re-elect new people, new services to be primary. And during startup, we said, well, we need at least 75%. It's a constraint that Fabric lays on us, and we need these numbers. So let's talk a little bit more about how that voting works. So to get at least 50% with 2 or 4 or 6 or 8 frontends, you need an uneven number of servers. Elementary school has taught me 2, 4, or 6 is not uneven. So what we're doing is we're getting another additional server with that. And the nice thing about Enterprise Edition is we have a SQL server. So we take the primary SQL server of your mirror to be our deciding vote. To see when we talk about voting who's primary or secondary. So does that mean that the secondary SQL server, so let's say your SQL mirror, your primary SQL server went down, does your secondary SQL server now get promoted to be a voter as well? No, it doesn't. So if you're in a 2 front-end server state and you have a SQL backend and you decided for the fun of it to test it to fail over to your secondary SQL mirror, your secondary SQL server in your mirror, and you now reboot the services, they will never get online because you cannot get quorum. It's one of the things that this is why we warn against don't do a 2 front-end edition server edition, because you will meet things like this. So you can open Windows Fabric to find out who's voting and who's not voting in these setups. Don't edit the settings.xml file. They're managed by Fabric. You can look at them. Don't touch it. It's looking, not touching. So they'll show you, like in this example, they'll show you pool A1 and pool A2. Those are the 2 frontends for my pool A. And they'll add SQL because it's only 2 servers. And when I get into 3, 5, 7, 9 or more servers, we only need the pool frontends. So why do I need voters? Why do I need quorum? Why do I need to elect things? Well, that's because we use user groups and Fabric. So previously, when we had our frontends, and our frontends used talk to our SQL backends directly, and we put all the information in SQL in the back, all was well. Up until you really want to scale to large deployments, or you wanted to make your SQL admins happy by not putting that much IOPS on your SQL server, we thought we have to have a better solution for this. Also, if we talk about deployments like Office 365, we've recently onboarded a customer that really wanted over 500,000 people in their deployment. Yeah, then getting a lot of pools doesn't really help us. We really just wanted to have a lot of frontends. So we needed to switch. So what we've done to get this to be less dependent on SQL in the backend and more reliant on our front ends is we created user groups. So because I did see a little mistake in this slide, I tried to correct it. I stole this from Brian. So it's his fault. So just the group tree in the middle on the bottom is supposed to be purple as well. But when we think about user groups, whenever your pool starts up, we put our users in nice little groups. And basically what we'll say is, well, let's say these 1,000 users are in group one, and we'll put all their information on front end one in this case. But sort of, let's say this front end were to die, it's kind of annoying if we just lost 1,000 users, we better have some copies. So what we'll do is that this server will send out copies to two secondary servers. Those secondary servers in this case, so the third and the sixth server, will get a copy of that user group. So they'll get a constant copy of the conference status, the contact list, basically all information of the users that we need to have. We do not copy online status, because as soon as they go to a different server, we know if they're online or not. So all the data we have about those users are distributed amongst those user groups. So when I'm signed into a pool, I will get, based on my user group, a primary front end, and I have two backup front ends. So in this example, you can see group one being distributed over three different servers, group two being distributed over three different servers, and group three being distributed to three different servers. We only do this for three different front ends. So if I have three user groups and I have six servers, it doesn't mean that each server will have a copy of all user information. We only do up to two copies of a user group. So when would we do only one copy of a user group? It's not even a copy in a statistician setup. In a two front-end setup, we would only do a single copy because you'd only have two servers. If you have three servers, it basically means that each front-end would host one primary and two secondary groups. Now, if I have a three front-end setup, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. This concept of putting users in groups and then making two copies of that is extremely important. That's the way link high availability works deep down below using Windows Fabric. If I were to take all three servers down for that user group, there's no more link for that user group. It's done. I have some examples about that, but that's a bad situation. Main advantage this gives us is if one of my front ends dies, it doesn't need to talk to SQL. I don't need to have all kinds of nasty conversations because I have at least one and possibly two front ends that have an exact copy of everything that user has done, all the data. So I can immediately fill over, this is done in seconds, well, less than seconds, and the user will see a quick pop-up of link signing in again. Calls will continue, everything will continue. If you're on a conference call and that front end happens to be hosting the conference call, yeah, your conference call will die, but all the other goodness will just continue. So this is our failover model for our users. We call this basically group-based routing. So all users assigned to that group are hosted on the same front end. Should that primary fail, we go to a secondary front end that also knows everything about those users. Here's the tricky thing. When I add a new front end or remove a front end or basically do stuff with my front ends that impacts services, I'm going to reshuffle all of my user groups. So this is exactly the reason why we can't do metropolitan data center design again. Because with a bit of luck, you could shuffle it in such a way that you would have half of the front ends in data center A and you would have a copy of all the user groups in data center B, and if data center A would fail, now at least they have a copy in data center B, but now your network admin does something silly like restarting link services in half of the data center, and now all user groups are reshuffled and you can start doing a nice rehoming of all your servers. So it's just technically not really feasible anymore. And yes, I know people will challenge me on that and say, well, I'm sure I could do it by just getting some movers and quickly shifting around servers. Yes, you could. It's not a good plan anymore. We have replica sets. And let's talk a little bit about the replication about those and the routing group's assignment to the replica sets. So if I look at those routing groups and if I have five different front ends, then each front end, so in this case, I have routing group one and routing group two. So one of my front ends hosts is the primary. In this case, the one down here that I made light green, this one hosts the primary. It's the primary register for my routing group. These two have copies. Let's say this one has the primary. Oh, let's say this one is the primary front end, and these two just have copies. You'll see that all users will be connecting to this front end. So although I have five front ends, in my example, only two are used. Real life, this would never happen. With the little exception of that I'll talk about later, but you get the concept, right? I get a primary front end for my user group. Should that primary front end fail, I'll go to the secondary user group. Sorry, routing group. We do synchronous data replication. So as soon as something changes, we immediately tell the other front ends. We don't use SQL in the back end for that. So once our front end knows about this, the primary front end is responsible for sending that data to the other members of the routing group. So this is all handled within the link pool without the use of a SQL backend. Some of the data we transfer, calendar data, some of the data we don't transfer is the calendar and the inactivity data and any existing phone calls, because as soon as a user moves, we know that user's in a call because the user is telling us they're in a call. We know that they're either busy or not busy. In calendar data, we've got exchange for that. The primary front end is also responsible for whenever there are changes to the user, to collecting that using our blob storage and writing that back to the SQL backend. That means that we only have limited use of that shared blob storage. We only need it when stuff's gone horribly wrong and we need to reprovision the front end with all that data, or when stuff, we have data rehydration. So we need to get more data or basically put data back. But that's only for the non-dynamic data. So we greatly reduced the amount of talking we had to do to our SQL backend. So a little bit about those replica sets. So a replica is set is a set of replicas of your routing group. So if I have, of each routing group, I've got three instances, three replicas, one primary, two secondaries. That makes sure I have three replicas, and three is an uneven number, which gets you quorum. Because we need to elect a primary server for our data. If one of them goes down, we can use the SQL in the back. We still have two servers plus SQL. We can get quorum, and we can elect a new primary. If two of those servers go down, I only have one left, and I don't have quorum, and I'm done. So you will need at least two copies of online of the secondaries. So killing off two front ends that host of one of those had the primary, one of them had a secondary copy of your user data is a bad thing to do. So if a replica goes down, the other one takes over as the primary. We do this by the re-election process. Fabric handles that for us. We will not suddenly try to build another replica. Makes no sense because you could just be rebooting a front end. So if you look at, there is a little script. Sorry, there's a little commandlet that you can use, the get-CSUserPoolInfo. And if I look at Amy Strand in this case, you can see that I have a primary pool. So that's pool A, and in pool A I have three front ends. And I can actually see this is my primary pool machine, my secondary, and this is also secondary copy. And should this go down, I still have one copy and my primary machine. And if this happens to be down for more than X amount of minutes, I get elected a new one. So I believe A2 is now new. So we do add new servers to those three copies. We just wait a little bit because we don't want to keep pushing data around if you just do a simple reboot. So that's the user group process. So looking at it, should that one server be down, and we didn't just get the third server in, and we just had two servers online, now a third member goes down, we now have quorum loss. We cannot vote for a new one. So at that point, yeah, I could still access my user data, and yeah, my user would still be online, but we will never recover. Unless those servers come back online, we are done. We need to reset quorum there. So very important concept. This is why you might get into situations where you have half your pool up, but now suddenly taking one more server down leads to half the people still having link, the other half not having link. So what happens during a pool startup? So when we start up a pool, our cluster server, so we call that our Pistio Fabric cluster, boots up, and we find a primary server for each routing group. The primary syncs the data from the blob storage in SQL to the primary server, and the primary server then sends that data off to the secondary servers. Should a front end ever restart, then at that point, Windows Fabric sends, basically, Windows Fabric is running in the back. It's not a link service. It's a different service that runs in the back. And Windows Fabric decides whether link services are allowed to start or not. So once this front end gets back online, Fabric in the back does its voting. It gets quorum. It sees, well, are you allowed to start up? Which rules will you be assigned to? Once that's all been decided, link can start up. We're either made an idle secondary or an active secondary, and we need to manage anything. We need three of the nodes to be online. So looking at that in a pretty picture, so we have five servers over here. Of those five servers, let's say I take server four offline. Server four was my primary server for my routing group. At that point, we'll say, well, you know what? I need to elect a new primary server. I can do that because I can still get quorum. I've now elected my third server to be the primary server for my routing group. And should that server now never come back online in those 15 minutes, we elect a new server to be our secondary server as well, and we rehydrate that server with all the information from our primary server. So SQL has no role to play in that. The only thing SQL has done now is being an additional vote in getting our quorum. But what happens to survivable branches and remote users? Survivable branches and any other services like our survivable branch service. Well, because your primary register is the branch server, we can only create one routing group for you. So if you build a 5,000 user branch and you assign 5,000 users to that specific branch, you will get a single routing group with 5,000 users. And our pool is still responsible for all user services, so you'll now get a single front end that is your primary server for your routing group. So your one front end is now hosting an additional 5,000 users. This has quite the impact when you're doing designing for branches. So if you, so this is also one of the reasons when we talk about, well, if you have more than 1,000 users in a branch, you might want to start thinking about things like, maybe you want to place an SZ there. Maybe you want to place an enterprise edition pool there if services for them are really important. Maybe you want to place multiple survival branch appliances there and distribute your users. Because if I can design a pool for 80,000 users, but if my pool is very heavily used and one single front end gets an additional 5,000 users assigned to them, that could be essentially, well, that could simply bring down that front end. So looking at that, if we use our, so there's a little script that you can use. It will get you the routing or distribution. So if I look at my pool, this is my SBS, so my survival branch server. You can see there's a single routing group. And you can recognize this because it ends at 6DC. So this one routing group and all my users. So for instance, you'll see the SBS 1 user number 1 assigned to this routing group. But user number 1,000 for this SBS gets assigned to the same routing group. And this goes up to 5,000 or however large you want to make the amount of users in that branch. Yes, we have a question.
Can you please tell me how does the routing group get created and how does the link decide which users go to
yes. the routing group? Yes. OK, the question is how does a routing group get created and how does link decide where to put users in a routing group? Fantastic question. I made a slide about that. So we'll cover that, and if I'm not being complete, then we'll address it then. So if we look at the same picture, the CS user pool info that we looked before at the user that was assigned directly to a front end pool, you can now see that the primary pool for this user is the SBS for both the 1 and the 1,000 user. Our backup pool is our pool A, but you can see that the preferred order is that we have a pool A tree and a pool A tree as the primary routing group server. So that's the primary machine that all those users will be talking to for all their user services. Now, with just 500 users, not a big problem. 5,000 users, maybe a bit of a problem. If we add a new SBS to the topology, Link is kind of smart about it. So when we have an existing amount of pools, I actually have 6 front ends, so pool A1 up to pool A6. You can see that with the routing group distribution, I don't necessarily assign a routing group to all front ends. So in this case, pool A6, so that front end was doing nothing at all. So when I add this new SBS, hey, I had to create a new route group. Let's be smart about it. Let's assign this to a front end that's effectively doing nothing. So we do look at not at the amount of users in a user group, a routing group. We do look at the amount of routing groups assigned to a front end. Should that be a small amount, that gets a higher order of placing a routing group on it. So that's the initial part of the answer. We look at the amount of routing groups inside a server. So, same deal here. So if we look at the previous name, so this routing group ends with B37. And if we look at creating a new user, you can see that they're in that specific routing group, B37. And yes, we created 5,000 users in that routing group. They're still assigned to that single server as being the primary server. The proof is in the pudding. There we go. So, yes.
Can I ask a question?
I think you can.
So we know that it's going to look at the different servers and see the number of users in a routing group. Does it take any consideration of the power of the server?
So it doesn't look at the amount of users in a routing group. That's what my script does.
Yeah.
When we distribute routing groups, we just look at the amount of routing groups on an existing server.
Okay.
But it doesn't take any account whether the server is virtualized or the amount of resources that server's got.
Well, the cool thing is we sort of fix that by saying mixing servers with different performance or mixing a virtual and physical servers in a single pool is not supported. So that sort of, we fixed that issue. But it doesn't. It's a fairly dumb mechanism, to be honest.
Thank you.
Gotta love when programmers fix stuff. They just tell you, well, we just don't support it, fixed. Looking at that, so this is basically a recap of before. Yes, we basically take pool A6 as our primary register. We have the two secondary pools in our routing group. That is our primary pool, primary front end, I should say. So how do we manage all of this? So, and we'll still get to the question, but now how do I do patch management? Because we talked about these three front ends, and let's say I have an 18 server pool and I'm doing patch management. I don't really want to do patch management on server one, reboot, wait for 15 minutes, do the next server. That's going to take me all night. So we've built the concept of upgrade domains. And we take upgrade domains into account when we distribute the routing groups. I keep saying user groups. When we distribute the routing groups. So we make sure that you have upgrade domains that basically have non-vital routing group components. So your upgrade domain are the servers you can take offline and reboot without a problem at the same time, and then move to the next upgrade domain. And we'll actually tell you if you can turn them off or not. So it's a logical grouping of servers on which software maintenance, such as upgrades and security updates, are performed at the same time. We have a picture for that to make it look better. So what we'll do, so if we place routing groups, so on node one, I'll put my primary, node two and node three, my secondary copies, and I'll distribute this in such a way, so this is where the placement comes into, uses the upgrade domains for finding the correct front ends. So we place this in such a way that taking down upgrade domain one, so node one and four, will make sure that in any case, there's always two copies of the same routing group available. So we can still elect a new primary, we can still get new servers in, because what would be a very bad thing is if you would, because taking two, let's say I would take down node one and node two. Well, as long as they come back up, I'd be kind of okay. Yes, they host both the purple and the green, two copies of those routing groups, but as long as they come back, I can recover from my quorum loss and I'm good. But my patch wasn't tested that thoroughly, so those servers never come back online. Well, not a problem. I'll get two new fresh link servers in, right? Yeah, no. It's done. You now have to reset the complete quorum. You have to reset all of that niceness, and I'm going to give you some commandlets for that. But you don't know that. Because you went to this session, but your colleague didn't, and you forgot to tell him. So now node 3 goes offline. Ooh, 15,000 people without link. Very unhappy day. It's the little things that we don't really tell you about. And yes, this is documented on TechNet in such a way that it's fantastic to read. So this is why we need to upgrade domains. And if I take down an upgrade domain and that upgrade domain would never come back online, there is no problem. Because I can re-image the servers, get link back online, just reinstall them. I can see, well, okay, I still need a secondary copy. I'll put them on those servers. So how many upgrade domains do I get? So there's a fixed formula built into Topology Builder. So with five servers, I have five upgrade domains. With nine, I have eight. With eight, I have eight. With 12, I have eight. Do I know the logic behind this? I do not. This is one of those mysterious formulas that got made up over either beer or whiskey or whatever their preference is, and they made a formula for this, and that is how it is. You can, however, exactly see how those upgrade domains are matched and which service you can take down. What happens, though, is as soon as I make changes to my front end, so I take out a front end or add a front end, I'll do a complete reshuffle of my routing groups and my placement of users in routing groups, and therefore also my upgrade domains. So if I go from 8 front ends to 5 front ends, I'm going to cut down in my upgrade domains as well. If I go from 8 front ends to 12, lucky you, the amount of upgrade domains never changes, but the placement of the servers in those upgrade domains might have changed. So I really want to urge you, don't make notes of which servers are in which upgrade domains, but check every time you want to do stuff to them, because they might and will change. So how do I upgrade? I've made a very nice diagram for that. The easiest thing to do is get-cspool upgrade readiness state, and it'll tell you exactly if you can take down an upgrade domain or not. The reasoning behind this, let's say you had a failure or something starting up, and we are still reprovisioning one of the front ends to get sure that our routing groups are in a healthy state, it might tell you just don't do this just yet. You can also download the presentation afterwards, and then these things are actually way more readable. Because I really have to go deep into the screen to read them right now. So what happened to the two-node front-end pools? Some people say they're not supported. Untrue. They're very much supported. They're just a bad plan. Because they'll work all of the time, except that one day where you decided, oh, I'll install this patch in the morning, and the CEO has to do a call this afternoon, and then stuff doesn't work, because that's the day when stuff always decides to fail. If you document this very well, and you stick to these rules, the pool will keep working. There are, however, catastrophic events that might prevent Link from being happy. If I have a SQL failure and your DBA for some reason took down your primary server and you decide to reboot one of the front ends or maybe two front ends because you felt like it, well, this is where good communication with the DBA comes into account. If you ever did want to do the two front-end deployments, make sure to either restart both FEs at exactly the same time or bring them back up in reverse order. So if first one, then two goes down, then make sure you reboot one, that you reboot two, then reboot one. Because we're just so friendly, there's a reset that you can reset a pool quorum loss. You need to reset type quorum loss recovery to fix this. And you can see you're in this bad position because the front end service is in a ever so happy state of starting, which is a lie because it never starts. It just tells you it will start. So that's the two node front end pool. Yes, question, cool.
Can it do harm if I put the reset command in the startup of the server?
Yes. It can.
Okay. To be sure that if they both start or not exactly the same time, and I don't know which one was going down the last, it will always come back with a resetted quorum.
Yeah. Well. So you mean this?
Two note.
So if you put in this commandlet, the reset type quorum loss recovery, although not very nice, you could potentially do that. You're preemptively fixing a problem. I couldn't do much harm. It's not nice. Couldn't do much harm. If you do the reset pool commandlet on its own, that's a bad thing to do. And I'll cover that later on. Yeah. So you could potentially do that. I would save the I would just deploy a third front end, to be honest, just to get rid of it, because it'll make your upgrades way more easier and doing patch management stuff like that. But sure, you could do it.
Okay.
So same as before. So if I have a primary pool, secondary pool routing group, so that routing group will still show. You see, I lost my train of thought. It's a good question, though. So how do I get my routing group order? Use the get dash cs pool user pool info minus identity then the username, and you'll get your information about which user is assigned to which routing group and what's the order of the routing group. So we have that. Another commandlet that comes in handy is the get dash cs pool fabric state. It'll tell you everything about the fabric state in your pool, whether it's healthy, unhealthy, whether it's waiting for stuff. And the get dash cs pool upgrade readiness state will tell you, can I actually do patch management right now? Are we still waiting for any additional stuff I need to do? Now, this is the question when we talk about, so can I just do reset cs pool register state? I wouldn't just do that. So, because when you do a full, so by default, it uses the service reset, which basically it just wipes out anything that has been thinking about your services, where they're running, which one's primary, which one's secondary. But it doesn't help you recovering from quorum. So running this commandlet does reset service assignment. So it completely whacks out your upgrade domains. It completely tries to reassign them. But it doesn't fix your quorum issue. Full reset, same thing. You need to do a full reset by reassigning all those nice little user routing groups and all those nice little service elections when you do a change, for instance, from one front end to more front ends, two to more, or from more back to two or to one, because they will trigger upgrade domain changes. The quorum loss recovery is exactly what it states it to do. It will help you recover from quorum loss. It will find you a fake new voter to recover from that quorum loss. And machine state removed will do that. You wanted to remove a machine from the voting process because it crashed or for whatever reason. you want to do that in the occasion of, because pool change topology changes aren't processed until Link completely boots up, but Link doesn't boot up because the machine was removed from topology. It thinks there should be three machines, but there aren't because you removed the third. That's why you can use the reset dash cs pool register state minus machine state removed. Please don't use this without defining what you want to do, either a full reset, quorum loss recovery, or service reset, or machine state removed, because then it'll do just whatever. It'll just do a service reset, and in most cases, it will not fix your issue, because it will not fix quorum loss recovery. And that's the one most people will need. So, what happens if it doesn't work? We need, if Link is stuck at starting, we need at least 50% of the front ends to be online in a started state, or else Link cannot start new services. We cannot do voting. If you see server startup is being delayed because Fabric Pool Manager is initializing, which we've all seen, that is quorum loss. That is where that reset type comes in handy, or you might want to start more front ends. If your pool's fully stopped, you need 85%, or else there will not be a new quorum placement. You see, now that comment from the beginning makes way more sense. Should have saved that comment. Yes.
Yeah, I just have a question to the previous slide. I wanted to ask this question at the end, but now I see it. The number is here 85%, and
yes.
That is the number I know was been mentioning all the time, but today you were mentioning 75% as for the pool startup.
That is my mistake, and I apologize for that.
So is it 85?
It's 85. It's, okay. So 75 was in my head. It is 85. Very well. I'll give you a wristband. You can come to my party. I'm sorry. That you're correct. It's 85%.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
A lot of stuff in my head. So what happens? So from a user perspective, and I'll go through this rather quickly. So what happens if Amy Strand's logged in? I have my three servers. So I've got server 3, 6, and 1. One of them goes down. So my server 3 goes down. At that point, she gets signed out. But immediately she gets signed it back in because we do a vote and we see server 1 is now the new server. If you want to take a screenshot of this, you have to be rather quick because this happens really in seconds. Users will not really notice that this ever happened. And the one below, as soon if that server doesn't come back up, we'll re-elect a new for the secondary copy and we'll transfer contents over there. So what happens, from a SIP perspective, when I try to sign in, I get a 301 redirect to my correct front-end pool, front-end server. That front-end server is unavailable right now because server 3 was down. We basically go back to the server and tell them, well, it's a good try, but that doesn't really work. That server then tells me, oh yeah, you're right, I can see that Fabric has processed this now, I've got a new primary front-end for you, so you'd better try number 2. And Amy goes to number 2, and now everything works, and everything's happy. but what about a 2 front-end pool? So what happens there? I only have two servers, one of them goes down, I still get the election of, I still get the secondary copy becomes the primary copy, and everything works. So we put a little asterisk in there, because yeah, it'll work fine, until everything is down, or I get the weird SQL stuff in the back. It's the two front end, I think the easiest way to describe it will always work just fine until that very important day comes along where you went out to lunch and the CEO needs to make a call and someone restarted the services. So what happens if all my copies are offline? So I have a 15 front-end pool, and I take the three front-ends that have either the primary or a secondary copy, I take those three offline. So Amy Strand, she's always the the subject of bad things in my demos. So she's assigned to 4, 5, and 2. This is a routing group ID. And we're going to take her offline. So we're going to take server 4, 5, and 2 offline. Please note, if you're going to replicate this in your lab, either kill the network connections or kill the machines. Stopping link services is not enough. Fabric is part of Windows, not part of Link. So the election process will still go on if those machines are online. So I've killed off those machines. And at that point, the routing group is dead. There's no way to re-elect new ones because no one is alive in that routing group. We can't really do something. So if you look at the routing group and if you look at the get CS pool fabric state, it will tell you there are no primaries. There's no one in this routing group left. So this is an excellent time to run our nice commandlet, reset type quorum loss recovery. Any of the other reset types, even a full reset, will not help you because you've lost quorum. You've not lost services, you've not lost voters, all your voters are still there. It's quorum for this routing group that's gone. So what this commandlet does, it actually checks, are those front ends still alive? Are they still there? Does it still work? No, they don't. I'm going to remove them completely and I'm going to assign new front ends. At that point, once that's done, I've placed three new servers in my routing group. One of those servers will be elected as primary. That primary server will connect via blob storage to my SQL backend. I'm going to rehydrate all my information, and my primary server will inform my secondary copies of all the information that's there. So that takes seconds up to half an hour. And the reason behind that is that this works like a charm in a lab with five people in my contact list, a little bit of information. Do this in a production environment with thousands of users in a routing group, you will not have such a fun time. Because we need to rehydrate all that information back from SQL, back to our front ends, redistribute that, and then Amy's back online. So if you want to test this, do this in a lab, not production environment. So some of the back-end high availability. So we've had some questions, an interesting setup about this. So yes, SQL mirroring is active-passive. Yes, we recommend a witness server. Yes, SQL Express can be the witness. No, you shouldn't install SQL Express on one of the SQL servers. That sort of covers off 90% of the questions. And yes, we've had people trying to install SQL Express on one of the SQL servers. Yes, question.
Can you use
Azure as a witness? Can you use Azure as a witness?
Can you use Azure as a
witness? Azure.
Oh, Azure. No. No. Unfortunately not.
Boo.
I would love to say yes, but no, at this point, no. Technically, perhaps. Technically, perhaps, outside supported boundaries. We have this beautiful picture of the sea of supportability with a nice little diagram that says good plans, and we have got a nice little corner that says this is supported. Good plan, not supported. So this is how our SQL high availability backend looks like. So we have a primary copy, our principal SQL mirror copy, and we've got our mirror. So when you set up the SQL mirror, the most common errors that we see, don't use a DFS. So when you install this, you need a file share for a one-time copy of all the mirror information. You cannot use DFS because DFS by default ignores all BAK files. What does SQL generate for the copy? BAK files, and they will not be accepted by DFS. So that doesn't work. No, you cannot use the link share for the very same reason. So it's a one-time file share for all I care. Use your own laptop. You need it once, then it's done. Poor defaults, 5022, 7022, change this as much as you'd like to. They are the mirroring endpoints in SQL. We suggest these ports. Do whatever you want with them. Yes, we support SQL Express as a witness. For some reason, many customers do not really want to buy another SQL license for just a witness. Make sure that you enable TCP IP, and if you have dynamic ports, install the SQL browser service or it won't work. I took out two specific slides, which might be in your downloads, and I'm going to address them quickly because you might see them in your downloads. We once sort of talked about we would do always on for SQL in Link 2013. We cannot do that. So at this point, we support SQL clustering. We support SQL mirroring in Link 2013. Always on will not come in Link 2013. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but that is sort of the bad news. quick look at disaster recovery. So our disaster recovery setup is our backup service. So as soon as you assign a pool pairing, and you can assign enterprise pools on a one-on-one relationship. So if you say pool A is the is in a paired pool relationship with pool B, then pool B is in a committed relationship with pool A by default. You cannot do a try existence. So it has to be a one-on-one relationship. It can only be enterprise to enterprise, standard to standard. it is not automatic. Also, if you do not deploy this on day one, you will need to run the link installer again. Either the command line or the nice little GUI, but you will need to install the link backup service, because that's only installed if the pool's in a pad pool relationship. What is automatic should a pool fail? That's the voice failover service. So should your pool fail, then voice calls will continue should you set up VoIP in such a way. Full service failover towards your backup pool is only manual. The reasoning behind this is, well, if your pool's down for a minute or so because of whatever patch management you're doing, you don't really want to do a complete pool failover. The link backup service, that is only installed as soon as you enable the pool for pad pool. It synchronizes the user data, conference data, basically everything that's in the pool blob storage towards the other pool. We use, by default, every 2 minutes. Should your recovery plan require for a slower or a faster a copy, you can change that. We've got that well documented on TechNet. We use zip files. The source pool basically tells the backup pool, well, you know what? I've got a lot of changes. You really need to get those new changes. So what happens at that point is we create a zip file. The zip file is set in a temporary directory. We copy it over, and by the use of a cookie, we call the high watermark mechanism, and I don't know why, but that's a good name for it, I guess. We give the cookie back to the source pool, telling them we've copied the latest changes, and the contents of that cookie basically tell them we've copied the latest changes from this point. Now the source pool knows this is the moment from which I need to generate my new delta. If you use invoke CSPool failover or the backup CSPool commandlet, we immediately try to make another new delta, so that should you ever need to test a pool failover, you will always get the latest data. and of course, because we are in a monogamous relationship, we do that both ways. So source pool to backup pool, and immediately the backup pool synchronizes to the source pool as well. So where is that nice little zip file? That is in the local file store. It then gets put on the file share. The file share is specifically under backup service, backup store temp. You can find that zip file. So if you monitor that directory every few minutes, you'll see a nice new zip file. It's copied over to the backup store, and the backup pool imports it and makes sure all changes are there. That way, both pools will have a full copy of the blob storage of each other's pools. So should a complete pool fail, the backup pool will have all the conference data, body lists, all those nice little things that users tend to appreciate. Cavet. Yes, the central management store fully supports that backup pool mechanism. So we can only have one central management store. Should that central management store, should the pool hosting the central management store fail, you can run the invoke CS management server failover. The note here is that you need to be part of the RDC config replicator group. And the computer account is added to that specific group. The way Windows Server works is that membership changes only get processed when a server reboots. So you cannot fail over the central management store until you reboot that newly added server, which would probably solve quite a bit of your lab issues. I know this was one of my fun lab issues. Manual process, just like the invoke CSPool failover. GeoDNS, Microsoft, you don't support GeoDNS. Sure we do, not a problem. Should you want to do a GeoDNS setup, for edge servers and things like that, fine. you can do that. You get an automatic redirect, so I don't really see why. The one thing that you can certainly use it for, and we would actually recommend using this for, is when you go into like meet and dial in URLs to reflect you to your closest server. You can also use it to reduce complexity in setups. You don't need to push like hard-coded URLs, things like that. It's not a requirement by far. You can use it. We certainly do support it, so I wanted to cover it. Now, the ugly duckling in the pool, persistent chat. Yeah, so when I talked about the whole metropolitan data center design, and you can't stretch pools, well, you have to with persistent chat. So if you have multiple, if you have the need to have a highly available persistent chat pool, including disaster recovery possibilities, you will need to stretch that persistent chat pool. We fully support stretching the backend for persistent chat as well. You can also use log shipping together with SQL to make sure that it would then become a manual process, but you can re-import all SQL changes into your new SQL backend and get persistent chat back online. So log shipping is, by the way, also supported for the link pool. So some of the disaster recovery management, so the backup service, you can easily find that using the getcs backup service status. I've put in the things you'll most likely see. One of the things that you'll see is not initialized. It doesn't mean it's broken. We just didn't get around to synchronizing yet. So if you see that in a lab or a production environment, give it some time. What you also need to remember is once you install that paired pool, you will need to run either Bootstrapper or the GUI to make sure that you actually install the link backup service, because it's only installed once you enable that pool for paired pool. Some of the commandlets you need, getcs backup service configuration, backup relationship, and backup service sync. And I think that with 3 minutes to spare, that is my portion, and I'm very happy to answer any questions on HA and DR. You've already earned a wristband, so it's good. I'll still answer your question. So it's six something. I fully realize that. I fully support you if you want to go out and start beer drinking. Please remember we've got Channel 9 live here, and we've got a lot of nice resources on that. Also on the HA and DR sessions. If you want to look at this back and slow down my voice, you can do that on Channel 9. We have the booth. I'll be at the booth the rest of the week. And please complete the evals. And that is me, and I'm open to any questions you might have.
Okay. I just wrote one question, and that is over the course of this presentation, you said that if you lose all three servers in a replica set, that the user is like bad time. What I heard from other like speakers before is that it's enough to lose two of those, and the user is done. And he actually can't log in. Is it so, or? Has it been changed with some cumulative update?
It depends. It is safe to assume you cannot log in anymore, because you've got a 66% chance you cannot log in anymore. Because if you take away the primary and the secondary can never become the primary, because you can't vote. There's no quorum to make the vote. And let's be honest, Murphy's Law says it will be the primary and the secondary. Should it be the two secondaries, you can still log in because there's a primary. So for ease of conversation, and because I know people will try this and will then tell me, well, it didn't work, assume that when two are down, you're done. But because I don't want to be proven wrong, I have to be very correct when I say if all three of them are wrong, they are gone, then no more login for you. There might be a slight possibility with just two of them gone that you can still log in. Depends on the stand of the moon, I guess. Yes, and I have a wristband for you and for your companion, so you can go together, because you asked two questions. So that's, if you combine, then we're good. Yes.
My question is, in a high availability configuration, you mentioned that all servers should be within the same site.
Yes.
What is site in this, what do you mean with site in this configuration?
That's a good question. I'm going to say data center, same data center. I think that's the best description for it. If that answers it. So if you want to place one link server in the southwest corner of the data center and one in the other, that's fine. That's not a problem. What we really want to guard against is people having five data centers and then putting link servers in one pool over five different data centers.
Why not?
Because of what I explained with the routing groups. There's no way you can properly... You do that because if one or two of those data centers would fail, you have the certainty that link is still online. You don't have that certainty. Because should it be your primary and your secondary server in your routing group, no link for a set of users. And you can only recover from that by manual action. And if you want to do manual actions, please use a backup pool. Because at that point, you will have ensured high availability within a site, and you will have need to take a manual action should a complete site fail anyway. Make sense that way? If you come by at the booth, I'll make a nice drawing for you. And we'll talk about it, and I'm happy to hear your thoughts. It's certainly technically possible. It's not very feasible in the end. But you earned yourself a wristband. There we go. Yes?
I was just going to comment on that point in terms of failure domain. It's important to kind of consider what's going to break when you're looking at how you distribute stuff.
Yes.
If you've got five rooms in the same campus that are all basically on a LAN together, that would be a data center or a site.
Yeah. Well, so don't get too hung up on what a site is. So if you have multiple cabinets in a data center or whatever, it's fine. Just think about I want, so your objective is I want high availability for my users, right? And high availability within a site means I have one or two front ends going down and everything still works. Or I want to do patch management, things like that. If it's all in the same building or there are three buildings and dark fiber between it, fine. But what we see what most customers are doing, they have a campus, they have two data centers, there's a dark fiber between them, and now they put half the front ends in place A, the other half in place B, and now place A dies. Well, if place A had your primary, secondary server of your routing group, there is a set amount of users that will not get any link services unless you take manual action. And if you have to take manual action, do the paired pool setup, because that will get you both local high availability as will get you just the same functionality that you then have to do with the recover from quorum loss. It's a potato story. Hope it answered the question. Sorry?
In this case, you see the one user group connected to one data center.
Yes.
Okay.
We had a mic. Oh, microphone. Yes.
Hi. With Mike. Cool. Actually, I have two questions. One is the TechNet. It says if one of my front ends in an enterprise pool dies and it's for a longer time, not mentioning what longer time is specifically, mm-hmm. I should remove it from the pool.
Correct.
So what at what time is it? 1 hour or 1 day?
So we talked about you need an X amount of servers online to start your pool, right? 85%. Thank you for correcting that. So 85%. So we don't look at the actual front ends. We look at what topology builder told us that the front ends would be. So if I have a pool of five front ends and one of them goes down and it doesn't come back, right? and I restart the other four, I can never get 85% because Topology Builder told Fabric and told all our front ends there's supposed to be 5. So I need a fifth to boot my pool. I will never get that fifth because it's broken. Okay, so what's the longer time? I would say the time you expect
for the next pool boot.
Yeah, maybe not. To have passed until you have to reboot a pool or do patch management, things like that. Oh, okay. So if it's down for 10 minutes, I probably wouldn't remove it.
Sure.
If it's a week or more, I'd probably remove it. Mm.
Another short question. I saw you had some PowerShell scripts to get routing group IDs for a specific user. Are the scripts available?
So if you, I believe that we've put them somewhere on TechNet. If you don't have them, ping me and I'll get them for you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Fantastic. If we're happy, then you're all excused to go. I have the wristbands for the people I promised them to. I think I didn't promise more than 5, so I think we're good. And thank you.